Hi, I'm Chris Wright, and welcome to the first edition of Right on the Nail for 2024, which promises to be quite an important year, especially in the UK and the USA, where elections will be taking place. But it's going to be a pretty important year everywhere else in the world because there is so much going on. So we have a really interesting panel today to talk about what's going to happen in 2024. I'm joined by Chief Economic Advisor and Board Member at the Centre for Economics and Business Research, Vicky Price. Also by Jess Barnard, Labour National Executive Committee member and admittedly to the left wing of the party. I think Jess would admit that. And also by Edward Hardy, journalist and US and UK political commentator. And we can talk about the US as well today. So our hopes and our fears of all the years for 2024. Jess, what's your biggest hope for the year we've just entered?
My biggest hope. Well, firstly, Happy New Year, Chris, and Happy New Year to everyone listening. My biggest hope for next year, I guess, is obviously in the UK, we're going to be having a general election. I think we're all pretty ready to see the back of the Tories. I dare say all, but, you know, hopefully the majority of people are ready to see the back of the Tories. But my hope is that, you know, the next Labour government, obviously it's likely that there will be a Labour government at the next election, is one that prioritises like the things that actually people care about in their day-to-day lives. And that's things like bringing down NHS waiting times by investing in them, making training a priority, and bringing in rent controls, I think, has got to be a big hope of mine, and addressing the housing emergency, you know, like equipping local authorities with powers and finances to build social housing. I think those would be my sort of top hopes for what a Labour government like should and could deliver. But whether they will, I think, you know, there's like conversations we had about the sort of political will and whether they're going to be kind of dragged into these sort of divisive like arguments and topics that are kind of created by the Tories or and the right wing media, but actually don't really impact people's day to day lives. So I think there's a little bit of fear tied in with it. But those would be my main hopes for next year.
So both your hopes and your fears are tied in with the Labour victory at the general election and what kind of Labour government we have. Do we, Edward and Vicky, think there is any chance whatsoever that there will not be a Labour government by the end of 2024?
I think that's got to be one of the fears of 2024, the problem that that could emerge politically. Not necessarily a Labour defeat. I think most people looking at it would say that Labour are on course to be the largest party at the next election. But the potential issues that could emerge if Labour doesn't win enough seats to have a majority, whether that's being a minority government that's supported by another party, whether that's a coalition, whether that's a second election in 2024 or early 2025, I think that is the fear that people might have, the uncertainty that could emerge, and then the impact that could have economically on the UK. Obviously, the UK has recovered from a few economic shocks in recent years, including self-inflicted ones by the Conservative Party. And I think the uncertainty could unsettle the recovery that we're starting to see in the UK. That could also be paired by obviously what happens, and I'm sure we'll come on to it, across the pond in the United States, the outcome of that election, potential uncertainty that could emerge there, maybe going back to a Trump administration. There could be a risk, obviously, if the House and the Senate become Republican and the White House stays Democrat. There's a lot of potential uncertainty. I think that's where people are probably deeply concerned about, a time when people really want to be able to look forward, to know what's ahead, to be able to start to shore up their finances, to prepare for the future. I think there is a lot in play in 2024 that could shake up the political system.
Well, let's come back and talk about the United States a little bit later. But Vicky, as we all know, it's all down to the economy, really, when people cast their votes. And I know, I mean, almost you could almost say the economy could suddenly be absolutely booming and it couldn't save this Tory government. But one never knows, and it is down to the economy. And what do you foresee for the economy, and how much do you think the government can stimulate the economy to get to the point that people do, when they go and vote, have that feel-good factor and say, you know what, the corner's turned, this lot do know what they're doing.
Well, the first thing is whether it's necessarily in the hands of the government to make people feel considerably happier, because geopolitics matters so much, not just necessarily what's going to happen in the US, but we've seen all the conflicts and the fact that everyone felt poorer over the last couple of years has been because of international factors, it's been because of energy crisis, the prices going up very significantly, and the cost of living issues have been so important for many people. And that has been one of the main issues one had to deal with. Now, it could happen again. I mean, it's true that things have calmed down. We are living right now in a much more benign environment from that point of view. Inflation has been reduced in many countries across the globe because of lower energy prices and lower food prices. In the UK, not quite so fast, but it's happening. And finally, real wages are happening as well, in the sense that we're seeing wages rising slightly faster than inflation right now, which is good news as well. Anything could upset this. We're seeing what's going on with the Eastern Mediterranean. The war there may escalate. The war in Ukraine carries on. And of course, we've also seen these attacks in the Red Sea, which suggests that perhaps at the end of the day, prices might start going up again because of the delivery issues. Things not moving around as easily as one would like to see them happen, because we had just got over all the supply chain issues and now they will be re-emerging. Unfortunately, the situation continues. So there's a lot that's going on, which whichever government is going to have to deal with anyway. And there's a bit of luck involved. If things go well, then obviously people will feel happier. But I think, as you rightly say, they will have to feel much happier if the Conservative Party had any chance of being re-elected. But otherwise, I would imagine that we'll be looking at a new government.
What about increased Brexit tariffs, which are being introduced? Is that going to have a negative effect on the price of goods and the economy in general?
Well, Brexit has been an issue for quite some time. As we know, what the UK has done is hardly changed anything. It's been allowing things to come in without any extra checks, really, to speak of, or any tariffs. Of course, we don't have tariffs between the UK and the EU on goods. But of course, there are all sorts of other costs that businesses have to put up with, such as rules of origin, basically to prove, if you like, that anything that we export to Europe, where there are, in fact, checks and quite significant checks on that, have a substantial either UK or EU element in them, and that for the element that isn't EU or UK, we've actually charged proper tariffs because they're no longer in the common tariff area of the EU. So all of those things complicate matters. And when you look at agricultural products, there is quite a lot of checking going on for anything that goes from here to Europe, and not necessarily the other way around yet. And we've postponed and postponed and postponed all that. We've even postponed it in terms of checks of rules of origin for cars for a number of years to ensure that there is some smooth trade across and to ensure that we give our electric vehicle industry some chance to at least be able to develop and compete. So we haven't really imposed an awful lot from this side. More has happened the other side, but even there are concessions being given all the time to ensure that at least things don't just stop being moved across. But loads and loads of small firms, I'm afraid, have given up. Something like 30% of small firms, according to the British Chambers of Commerce, which used to trade with Europe, no longer do.
Jess, looking at what's happening with Reform UK and the extent to which it might split the Conservative vote and have even, you know, long-term ramifications for the Conservative Party, are you looking at that and thinking, yippee, or are you looking at that and thinking, oh my word, what is happening here? This could confuse everybody.
Yeah, well, I don't sort of see it as a positive thing. I think the Reform Party is quite a scary party, to be honest. The thing to consider is that the Conservatives do have form for shifting rightwards where they see it is electorally beneficial to them. And so I think what we can anticipate is that going into the next election, the Tories will be chasing that vote and we will continue to sort of drive those quite reactionary politics. I think we even saw, you know, at the Tory Party conference when they were talking about 15-minute cities and how, you know, this is somehow a plot to control us, keep us in our houses. And actually, it's just about people having access to, like, the services they need day to day. But it's kind of leaning on those fears of people. And the Tories do have form for kind of, you know, nudging themselves towards that voter base. So I think unless there is some kind of pushback from the sort of more middle ground conservatives, I think we can expect them to kind of keep creeping that way to make sure they don't lose too much of a vote from the Reform Party. In terms of what that means for like the conversation and where politics is going, I think it's really worrying because actually, you know, when you have a situation where the main party, the party of governance, are obsessed with, you know, things like 50-minute cities or demonizing trans people, it is absolutely outrageous at a time when people are affected by astronomical cost of living crisis and like what so many wider issues that just aren't being addressed. And obviously, as we've seen in the news over the last few weeks, there's so much corruption, financial scandals, you know, evidence of people giving their mates millions of public money while people in small businesses are in insecure jobs are really struggling. So I think it's not just a question of, you know, if this is a bad time for the Tories. I think this is quite a bad time for politics. It's a bad time for people's faith in politicians. And I think that this sort of divide issue is a bit of a distraction from the fact that they are a pretty corrupt party.
But Richard Tice, in his speech a couple of days ago, said that Reform UK were a working class party. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of the issues like the boats and immigration in general, and you know, is something which is, you know, high on the agenda of the Labour vote in general. And one wonders if Reform UK could actually end up taking a significant number of votes away from Labour as much as from Conservatives. Edward, do you see that as being an issue?
Yeah, this is probably the first and hopefully last time I ever say this, but I actually agreed with Lee Anderson on something where he gave his assessment of Richard Tice, describing him as a pound shop Nigel Farage. I think that's completely accurate. The Reform Party is so desperate to be a UKIP copy that I think people are going to see through the facades that they're trying to present about being working class. And I think that, to be honest, what was quite positive from Keir Starmer's speech earlier today, you know, his New Year speech, was the fact that he talked about this positivity in politics and going that way. And Jess was mentioning it there. And I think that's something that these attacks that parties like Reform are going to try and launch on Labour and the Conservatives to make themselves relevant. To be honest, I think people are quite sick and tired of this divisive, destructive political system, and they want to go back to a politics where parties are actually presenting things for the common good. They're not that, you know, parties can disagree. They can have their views on what policies need to be put forward. But this division that we see from political parties like Reform, from the Conservative Party in their political agenda recently, I think people are fed up of that and they want actually to have serious political discussions about what can be done to improve people's lives, whether that is on things like housing, the NHS, the economy.
Vicky, with the budget is particularly early this year, maybe only a week or two early, but it is early. Do you see any significance in having an early budget in terms of, you know, when the election might be or in terms of the greater economy?
I think there are two ways of interpreting that. I think at the beginning, everyone thought that perhaps that means that we're going to have an early election. And if you add to that what's happened with the National Insurance Contributions reduction, which is happening in January rather than waiting for that to take effect with the new financial year, it suggests that there's a bit of urgency to just get some things moving so that by the time we get to the election, there would be some positive things that have been at least announced, and maybe also people will have felt something positive in their pockets. So the overwhelming view for a while was that we were indeed going to see an election early. And remember, even now, Rishi Sunak is saying the working assumption is that we're going to have one in the second half. It means absolutely nothing. So an early budget does suggest that perhaps there is likely to be an early election, by which I mean May or June. People were talking about April before. I mean, who knows? You do need a bit of time after the budget to be able to sort of then announce an election starting as well. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of effort to make people feel happier. We talked earlier about well-being and whether people were going to to feel richer and therefore more likely to vote one way or another. It doesn't necessarily follow that if you're feeling richer, you will vote for the party that's there. You may decide to take more of a risk and vote for another party. So we've seen all that before. But in reality, there is a lot more that can be done. Not only taxes could be reduced, which I think is what the government is having in mind right now, or at least announcing a reduction in taxes, including possibly inheritance tax, but income tax as well. And the second one is what may happen to interest rates. If interest rates really fall as fast as they should do, unless those geopolitics, which Edward was talking about as well, suddenly mess the whole picture up. But otherwise, interest rates should come down very significantly through the course of the year. And they should really start in the spring, even though the Bank of England is telling us something different. If the Conservatives are lucky and those cuts happen in interest rates early in the year rather than later, then they might be inclined to do something early. If they want to wait and see the effect, because the cut in rates is a bit slower, then they might wait for a little bit longer. But I think domestically, the interest rate profile might be a very, very significant one for determining, if you like, at least the percentage of the votes and how people feel later in the year by the time the election takes place.
Yeah. Are you ready, Jess, at the Labour National Executive for April or May election?
I think so, yes. We're working on the basis of that, you know, there could be an election anytime, but particularly, you know, there's rumours circulating around of a May election, as Vicky said. So, Labour very much geared up, speeding up selections, getting candidates prepared. And obviously you've seen from Keir Starmer's speech today, you know, putting forward some of those ambitions for what government would look like under Labour. But I guess, you know, with all of these things, it's so hard to predict. The reasoning behind, like, there being caught being an earlier election, rumours are that the Conservatives are worried about their local election results happening, you know, being quite poor and happening just before a general election.
Well, I mean, from my standpoint, I'd say there's going to be an election. We probably know there's going to be a Labour government. Let's bring it on. Let's get it over with, and let's move on to the next phase in what's happening in the country, because we're in a state of limbo right now. Nobody seems to be able to do an awful lot whilst we know that something is going to happen. So for me, let's have the election sooner than later, and if there is a change of government, so be it. If there isn't a change of government, at least we know. But in the midst of all this, the one thing, when we talk about hopes and fears, we haven't yet talked about what's happening in the Middle East and also Ukraine. Ukraine's very much back on the agenda as well, because the Russians have been hammering the civilian population in the Ukraine over the last few days or weeks. I mean, this is a terrible situation one reads about in Gaza as well. Edward, you know, how can this all come to an end? I mean, you know, we're talking now about the fact that the Gaza situation might still be in the same place 12 months from now, as might the Ukraine situation. This is not acceptable in a civilized world, surely.
Unfortunately, for Ukraine and Russia, it's very much a stalemate at the moment. That one is one to particularly watch, because depending on the outcome of the US election, that could change rapidly. If Donald Trump takes power again in the United States, most people expect that the substantial aid package, military aid package that the US provides to Ukraine will come to an end, or there will be terms attached to it that Ukraine are probably uncomfortable to accept. Without that military aid, there is no...
But it's kind of teetering on the brink anyway, isn't it?
Well, Ukraine can hold their own at the moment, but without that aid, no country is going to be able to provide the support that they do. It's very clear in Russia that Vladimir Putin does not have the resources and firepower to keep this dragging on and on and on. It is only pride and ego that has stopped him from calling an end to this invasion. He can't admit that he was wrong and has lost, basically, to a much smaller power in the world. You know, if Russia loses to Ukraine, that is a humiliating blow at a time when he is trying to solidify his grip on power for the next potential decade, and he can't afford any slip-ups there. The situation in Israel and Gaza is a lot more tricky one to look at. What is becoming increasingly clear is that the UK and US are on the wrong side globally of this when you look at the response of other nations. We are increasingly isolated in our full-throated support of Israel, whereas you're seeing Middle Eastern countries, you're seeing those to the east, you're seeing, you know, countries in South America, they are coming together and saying that something has to be done on a humanitarian level. Putting aside the differences between Israel and Gaza, and that is a much deeper issue that goes beyond what happened in that deadly attack. It is a situation where humanitarian pause needs to occur. There needs to be a situation to protect civilian lives. It is very clear that that is where the majority of the world is, and we are not currently in that position politically. Again, that might change in the next election. I think you would hear a lot of Labour voices uncomfortable with Keir Starmer remaining in his current stance on that. I understand why he is, because it's a contentious issue, and Labour is trying their best to get into power so they can make real change. So I do understand why he is taking a cautious approach to this. But I think there are a lot of Labour voices you're seeing that would demand as a priority that Labour takes some strong stance towards a humanitarian approach. And that's something that will be interesting to see politically.
Certainly, Biden is losing a lot of votes in swing states like Michigan that he needs to win, to people that think what's going on is wrong. Vicky, what do you think about it? Are you prepared to sort of come out and say, I mean, you know, is the government on the right side of public opinion, and is what's happening there acceptable and an acceptable response to what was a terrible tragedy which kicked the whole thing off?
Well, what we do know is that what's going on right now is tragic. It's been tragic on both sides, and you're absolutely right. I think public opinion has switched. And also, it's just like Edward is saying, we seem to be out of line with what, you know, loads of our closest allies apart from the US are thinking, like France, for example. I mean, President Macron has come out and said ceasefire is what's needed, permanent ceasefire if possible. We changed our words a little bit, but not enough. So something will need to give. But of course, a lot will depend on what happens over the next few weeks or months, and of course the repercussions of what's going on right now across the region, those are quite significant, and of course what it will mean for possible terrorism or escalation in the Western world as well. So we've seen some evidence of that already, so it's not going to be an easy one to navigate, and I would imagine at some point there will be some consensus as to how to move forward. The real question is whether it matters at the end of the day what the UK says or does, because we're so insignificant by comparison to where we were before. You raised, Chris, the issue of Brexit. We're not part of Europe any longer. I mean, what really matters is Europe, the Middle East, really, and the US. And we're just, a rather small player in all this. And whatever we say, you know, perhaps we'll please the population if we do things differently and maybe give us a bit more of a voice, but in reality we are pretty weak these days, and despite the reincarnation of David Cameron as a Lord and as Foreign Secretary, we did think for a while that might change the tone, but it hasn't in this respect to any discernible effect at all. So I think it is a problem, and of course economically it is a problem. There is no doubt it adds an extra dimension of concern. If you add, you know, all the sanctions we already have against Russia and all the increase that we've got to do in our defense budget, not just us, but lots of others, that is a bit of a waste, because obviously that would go somewhere else. But it's interesting when you look at what's going on in Russia. I mean, Ukraine's economy is so badly affected with drops in GDP now for the last couple of years. Russia seems to be not doing that badly. It's managed to avoid most of the sanctions. It grew by something like 3% in 2023. That's the latest estimates, maybe even slightly more. It's spending a lot of money that it's earning still through exports. It's managing to avoid everything, or more or less everything, on pumping up. And I've heard what Edward said about not being able to sustain this military expense, but actually they're increasing it. 40% of the budget now goes on military spending. That is keeping loads of manufacturers going, and unemployment is very low, so people are getting paid. They don't complain too much. Obviously, there's staff shortages because loads have gone to be part of the army and to war. So Russia, strangely enough, is doing okay, managing to sell all its products elsewhere. Yes, there are many more sanctions just now being imposed as of the 1st of January. By the EU, at any rate, including sale of diamonds, which are very, very lucrative for Russia, exporting them. So there is a lot still going on, but they have managed so far to be able to continue to support the military spending. In fact, if anything, as I said, increase it, which is a worry as to, you know, where we might end up or where Ukraine might end up. And so those two conflicts are going to be with us clearly for the next year. And that's a big, big issue. And I think the diplomatic side is going to have to be sorted out by Labour as well as soon as they come to power.
I think there's an interesting point wider on this as well, that the situation Russia, Ukraine, the Israel, Gaza, the action that the West takes here and the behaviour of our politicians, also the results of the numerous elections, is going to also be increasingly important to a number of other territorial disputes that are going on around the world. You obviously have Azerbaijan and Armenia flared up. India, China has always been one where they are sort of a contentious with one another. There are a number of other places around the world where we could see that. In Africa, there's been a number of military coups and military activity taking on there. You know, there are nations around the world that are watching what happens in response to Israel, Gaza, Russia, Ukraine. And depending on the way those goes, depending on the approach of a number of elections, we could see more flare-ups globally. And again, that would potentially have a severe impact on the economic situation, which would then hit people here as well as around the world. It's something that really is at a tipping point, to be honest, globally. And it's important for the US and the UK to stand firm on the right side of these issues to make sure that the rest of the world knows what happens if you engage in military invasions of sovereign nations.
Yes, of course. Yeah, China and Taiwan, another one.
If I could just come in on the role of the UK on this as well. And I know, you know, I've spoken at length about Gaza and visiting Palestine on this show before. And I've made no secret of the fact that I think that Keir Starmer's comments earlier on were absolutely disastrous. And they were completely outstep with the majority of Labour members and Labour supporters, let alone, you know, the kind of the shift you've talked about in public opinion. But in terms of, you know, our role in the UK, I guess we can see ourselves as sort of small and fairly inconsequential. But I guess the reality is there are kind of tangible things that we can do. And we've seen this happen in response to Russia, right? We've essentially applied a sort of BDS policy against Russia, but we haven't seen that same response to Israel. And I guess the question is, why not? Why is there one rule for Russia and another for Israel in this situation? And, you know, I guess we continue to send arms to Israel and we continue to give fairly unconditional, like, diplomatic and military support to Israel. We've seen some sort of very soft, light touch comments from a few kind of politicians, but very, very few have actually kind of come out and condemned. So I guess, you know, the thinking in terms of what we can actually do, I would like to see a, you know, opposition to the anti-BDS legislation that's coming. I think it's coming for its third reading this week, if I'm not wrong. And that's quite an important piece of legislation which could impact our ability in the future, you know, and impact politicians' ability in the future to implement kind of consequences as a result of these actions of countries abroad. So, yeah, I think there's tangible things we can do, but there needs to be a political will to do it. And I think we need to be able to say, you know, like particularly in Keir Starmer's case, you know, I got it wrong. And we need to be doing much more to support Palestine and support those people in Gaza who are facing, you know, just unimaginable like horror.
Yeah. Are you likely to be a candidate for a seat at the next election, Jess? Have you been adopted by a constituency or likely to be in that position?
Sorry to disappoint, Chris. Not this time. I'm busy with my job, but I'll be out campaigning for some of the candidates near me.
Well, that's a shame. Well, it's not a shame you'll be campaigning, but it's a shame that somebody hasn't snaffled you up as their candidate, because I think they should do. But moving on, we're talking about hopes and fears. I mean, I would have a hope, and I don't know, it's a forlorn hope, but I just don't think that Joe Biden is electable at his age. I think the feeling amongst the American population is that, just come on, Joe, you're too old, you shouldn't be running again. Is there any hope that he's going to say he's too old? And is it too late for someone like Gavin Newsom or someone like that to be the Democratic candidate for the next president and to beat Trump? Because the way it's looking right now is that a criminal Trump is going to beat a very old Biden. Isn't that right, Edward?
Well, polls that have just come out are quite worrying for Democrats. They're certainly going to spark a fire under the Democratic Party with Hispanic support, support from Black people, support from young people having slipped substantially from the 2020 to 2024. Now, there has been some suggestion that the reason the polls look as weak as they do for Joe Biden is most people engaging in these polls don't actually think this is what the final matchup will be. President Biden's been fairly clear that his mission was to save the US from what he saw was basically certain disaster if Donald Trump had secured a second term. He saw that a bit as his, you know, arguably his final political mission. And that's why he ran for president in 2020. I think if Donald Trump wasn't on the ballot, I think there is a chance that President Biden steps aside and either lets his vice president or a number of strong candidates. There's people like Josh Shapiro out there. There's obviously Pete Buttigieg. There's obviously his vice president, Kamala Harris. There's a lot of candidates who Gavin Newsom in California, I think, would actually be someone who would probably take the lead in the Democratic field if Biden dropped out. So I think there's a lot of candidates that would be really strong for the Democratic Party who haven't thrown their hat into the ring because they're just letting it play out as it stands right now. But it really does come down to whether Donald Trump gets on that ballot. We're obviously seeing constitutional challenges that will go to the Supreme Court over whether or not he is even allowed to run for president, citing the 14th Amendment and his role in the January 6th insurrection. That's going to be one to watch and see how it plays out. There's obviously the criminal trials, multiple criminal trials, both at state and federal level that he's facing. There's a number of factors between now and when the election happens. And let's not forget, Donald Trump's main reason for running right now, setting aside his ego, is his desperation to stay out of prison. He thinks that if he gets back in, he'll be able to pardon himself. Now, the two front runners for the Republican nomination, Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, have both agreed, because it's the only way they're ever going to get Trump's supporters to vote for them, that they would pardon him on all federal charges on day one if they got into power. So that solved his problem there. So it might be the case that he looks at this and goes, do you know what? I'm going to step aside, throw my support behind a younger individual with less of the potential toxicity and allow them to go up against either Biden or another Democratic candidate. So there is a lot in play here. If I had to take a bet, I would say the election will be Biden-Trump, because I think that Trump's ego is probably going to stop him stepping aside. But there is a strong chance that both of them are out of this race in the next few months for, you know, a number of factors that are still in play.
But I genuinely can't see it. I think Trump's ego is such that he wants to be president again. You know, I take the point about, you know, getting pardoned for crimes of the past and that kind of thing. There's quite a lot of those on his agenda as well. But I think his ego dictates that he wants to be the most important man in the world. And he's got it in his grasp and he's not going to let go of it. I also wonder if the First Lady, Jill Biden's enjoying her role. We're seeing a lot more of her these days. We're, you know, standing by the side of her husband and making speeches and involved in things. So, Maybe
someone needs to prop him up while he's doing that.
Well, maybe she sees that as being her role, and also, but she's enjoying it. So I can't see that anything's going to change. And we're already January. We're going to have the primary starting. I mean, New Hampshire must be about 2 weeks away.
Oh, I was going to say, Trump will go into this and take the lead. But look, let's not forget that Trump is an unpredictable beast. And he could easily win the nomination and go, well, I've proved a point, and then step aside. You never know what he's going to do on any particular day.
I doubt that.
But I do understand your point about the ego running for president. But it's going to be an interesting one to see. But never underestimate Joe Biden. He has been underestimated time and time again, and he's always come out on top. In every major election he's gone for, let's not forget that he has been effectively the victor, with the exception of one presidential run back in the day.
He was written off in the January that he became president that he won the election in the November. He was written off after the early primaries. I think Iowa, after Iowa, he was almost dead and buried, and he recovered from that. So, you know, you're quite right.
Well, I would say that Edward's got a point that he may surprise us, and there aren't really any obvious candidates because his vice president isn't particularly highly rated, even though she's a woman. So I would normally be a supporter, but doesn't seem to be going down very well for some reason. And if it wasn't Biden, then I would suspect that the Trump lead would be even bigger, because it would be quite difficult to substitute for him. And as Edward said, we have tended to underestimate Biden. But the interesting thing on age is that Trump is going to be Biden's age halfway through the presidency. So it's not really an age issue, I would guess, for any of us who are growing old. I mean, it's rather nice to think that we've still got quite a few years before we can qualify to be US presidents. But it's more, you know, how they treat their term of office, if you like, and the way in which they generally operate. And Biden seems to be showing all sorts of signs of perhaps being a bit more exhausted than Trump, whatever it is that happens. But the age difference isn't that great between the two of them. But from a worldwide point of view, that the Trump presidency will be a bit of a disaster, in the sense that we would be expecting to see a retreat, an even further retreat from globalization, no support for Ukraine, if we believe anything that's been said so far, antagonizing all sorts of different parts of the world. Even attitude towards Putin isn't going to be very clear. Whatever may be happening on migration. So I think it's going to be an isolationist sort of withdrawal and declaring supremacy again, a little bit like before, which will have very bad implications for the rest of the world, for trade growth, and also in terms of the alliance, if you like, of nations standing up against the people who are now causing quite a lot of trouble in the world, the geopolitics we talked about before. So a bit of a concern, what will happen to growth more generally, and anything that reduces trade and increases tensions even more than what we've got already is not good for anyone, including the UK.
Yes, what about you? I mean, is this a horrendous thought for you to think that Donald Trump could be president of the United States again come the end of this year?
I mean, it's not a good one. I guess, you know, we have sort of luxury of being quite distanced from the US. I mean, I guess I couldn't be further from Trump's politics, to be honest, but I do find him a fascinating character to watch. And I do worry a little bit about the sort of the criminal trial sort of angle, in the hope that that will block him. I think that there were some elements of that before, you know, how we sort of used bureaucracy to sort of say, you know, he can be banned from Twitter, and that kind of gave him an extra boost. And he sort of says, you know, the establishment, they're against me. And he sort of galvanizes quite a lot of support during these moments. So I guess it's a bit of a worry that he can exploit this kind of time for his benefit. I do think we underestimated him, because I remember we're all laughing about the potential for a Trump presidency, and then it happened. And same thing with Boris, and then it happened. You know, they're quite similar characters in my view. So I guess it is a worry. It is quite likely he will win. And I guess if I was Biden's team, I would really be working on his sort of, you know, there is a bit of an image problem around Biden. There's a lack of trust in him. People don't really see him as capable of, you know, bringing in policies or even in like how he conducts himself in kind of public. So, but he did join a picket line. So that, you know, that was a great bonus that he did do. But yeah, I think if I was Joe Biden's team, I would be panicking a little bit and getting a bit of a strategy in place.
Edward, what's going to happen then? What's your prediction as to what actually will happen in the United States?
I think what's interesting about the situation and potentially is that if you look at the record of Trump, he didn't support really working class people who were what got him into power. He certainly didn't support minorities. And I think that when the election comes around, the results are going to be quite the shock for him if he does go for it. I don't see a world in which he does get reelected. Obviously, again, American politics was unpredictable. I think people were saying that in 2016, and we were all proved wrong. But it will be an interesting one to watch, certainly. But if you look at what President Biden has done, he's, you know, can present a strong slate of economic policies, strong slate of domestic policies. He's put America back on the foreign policy world stage with Antony Blinken going around the world and engaging in high profile meetings with people. And again, showing that America is trying to be a world leader. You know, the Israel-Gaza position aside, there are a lot of political situations they've got themselves involved in internationally. I think he's got a strong case to make to the electorate. And I think the working class fight that Donald Trump managed to somehow get into power in 2016, I don't think plays when you're against President Biden. He is a friend of workers. He's always been a friend of the workers. He is arguably the most pro-union president in history. And so it's going to be very hard for Trump to whip up the working class voters to get himself back into power.
Could I add something here? I mean, you're absolutely right. We had Bidenomics, of course, really, really important. The way in which through sort of COVID, there was this huge support for the economy that took place. The fact is still carrying on. The IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is helping manufacturing sector very significantly, and those are the sort of workers, if you like, that you're referring to. We have this huge infrastructure act with sort of trillions was going to be spent on this. Well, 1.9, if I remember, which is quite high. So yes, of course, there are problems with the debt ceiling and not being able to get various things through recently, including help for the Ukraine. But he's managed to get the money for Israel, nevertheless, recently, somehow or other, despite the blockages of the overall budget extension that he wanted. So you're absolutely right. I think the problem is that when the economy is doing reasonably well, which is doing right now, what you find is that people do have the tendency to take risks on the other side because they've done reasonably well. If they feared for their livelihood, they might be a little bit more careful. But perhaps the campaign hasn't quite explained that significantly, and I think that is probably where, you know, maybe if anyone was listening, they would focus on over the next few months.
Yeah, because you're quite right. The economy in America is certainly on the up, and it could be in a pretty decent space by the time of the election, and that might make a big difference. Talking of countries and economies, Vicky, I don't know if you got an opinion on this, but I'm talking about Argentina. How successful might the new populist right-wing president of Argentina be in solving their economic problems with his really strange policies that he's been intending to bring in and is bringing in?
Well, the most important thing is how they can keep the population still happy. We have inflation there of 150%. We have interest rate at 133%. So we're talking about a country in huge difficulty with current account problems. And yet it's a country which is very, very rich. But he intends to cut spending very significantly. So that's going to affect all sorts of people. Cancelling contracts, public contracts have already been given. That's going to alienate big business bodies and interests. So it's going to be quite hard. He had been talking about also abolishing the central bank, but I think he does need the central bank. He has also, at the same time that inflation is so high, practically halved the exchange rate of the peso. So that means, of course, more inflation to come. So it's going to be pretty hard for a while. The markets reacted, certainly at the beginning, quite positively. I haven't looked what's happened since the turn of the year. But they seem to think that this is going along the right lines. The IMF seems to be generally supportive, which, of course, has lent huge amounts to Argentina. I fear that there may be some popular revolt if results don't come quickly, because people will suffer in the short term. And then who knows what will happen politically.
Just a difficult situation, a difficult political landscape in a country which tends to swing from one side to the other without any real consistency, and the country always suffers as a result of it. So we've talked about the UK, we've talked about the conflicts in Israel, Gaza and the Ukraine, we've talked about the United States, we've briefly mentioned Argentina. Is there anything that we could say, you know what, in 2024, this is going to happen and it's going to really change the lives of people in general in a big way? Can we think of anything or that might just be a game changer for the world as a whole?
Well, it started to already play quite a big role in people's lives, but I think the impact of artificial intelligence, AI systems that are being increasingly embraced, whether that's in the audio, the visual, the written means, it could be for the positive. There's a lot of positive ways AI can transform and impact our lives. But there is also a lot of concern. You know, we're looking at two major elections, the UK and the US, which we talked about earlier. We've already seen the risk of deep fakes, AI audio and video being manufactured, and how that could play a role. So there is a risk about how AI could be used. You've seen figures like Elon Musk talk about how there needs to be regulation of artificial intelligence to ensure that it is used in a more safer manner and doesn't get out of hand. But it is something that I think could have a huge benefit for people's day-to-day lives, but also processes in companies to streamline efficiency, to find through data and information in a much faster and much more effective way. There's huge potential that it presents. It's just something that has to be carefully managed here, because there is, with every great invention, there's always another side to it where it could be used in a destructive or problematic manner.
It's certainly going to be a factor in our lives, and it's going to be something which, as you say, could impact us in a positive way or a negative way, depending on how it's been handled. Jess, can you see anything that you'd on the landscape that you think might affect us all in 2024?
Yeah, I think aside from, you know, there being a Labour government coming in, I think there is likely to be a continued growth of the sort of wider Labour and union movement, not just here, but in many countries. I think we've seen that happening already over the past couple of years. I know there's been a lot of strikes here in some, you know, like the train companies, so ASLEF and the RMT have been on strike a number of times in this country. But there's a number of other areas where we're starting to see sectors, you know, and companies seeing their workers unionizing where we haven't really seen them before. You know, so we've seen like Amazon workers going out on strike, Starbucks workers going out on strike. So I think we're likely to continue to see that growing and to continue to see workers bargaining for, you know, better jobs and, you know, better life balance, maybe 4-day week, better job security, better pay. But also I think we might see more workers taking action around holding governments to account. So, you know, we've seen workers taking action against arms companies and picketing outside arms companies who provide weapons to Israel. So I think that connection between, you know, workers organizing and then also holding governments to account is likely to only grow in 2024.
Okay, well, that's interesting. How about you, Vicky? Anything you see outside of the specific areas we've talked about?
Well, on the work front, I think I agree with Jess. But I mean, the interesting thing for me is, you know, we are going to have a little bit of an increase in unemployment taking place in 2024, whether we like it or not, because it's a lagging indicator. We're seeing that everywhere, including, in fact, in the US, and certainly in Europe, which is in recession. Quite a lot of the countries there are in recession, and they're not just in recession. Some of them are seeing deflation taking place. So the interesting thing on one hand is that I think hybrid work, for those who can do it, is here to stay, despite all the efforts of various companies to get everyone back to work at their desks, including, of course, the government, which is trying to do that now. I think a lot of those attempts are likely to fail, and I think that's good news. But, of course, only for those who can work from home, whereas obviously there's a huge chunk of the population, those who are striking, actually, who can't do that. They have to be out there and customer-facing and driving trains and all that sort of stuff. So a bit of inequality there emerging, which needs to be dealt with somehow. But the second thing is that will make a huge difference is a cut in interest rates. I think we will see a very substantial reduction taking place unless the central banks still stick to their group thing, which is that inflation is very high, we should just keep rates high. In reality, their high rates are only going to bring low growth in the economy. Inflation is an international factor, which has been affecting us quite significantly here and elsewhere, rather than necessarily a domestic one. We made it a domestic one by just keeping inflation expectations high, and therefore wages have picked up a bit. But overall, inflation, by comparison to other countries, but overall inflation is coming down and interest rates should come down. If interest rates come down, cost of living is eased quite significantly, despite all this stuff that we discussed on the geopolitics and what it might all mean at the end of the day. So uncertainty there. But overall, a much better situation than we had seen in 2022. I think that could give quite a boost to workers, a boost to consumer power, and hopefully a boost to incomes and growth. And businesses perhaps will become a little bit more optimistic and start investing. That's going to take a bit of time. But we could see a change in the world environment if those rates come down, as they should and should have done much earlier than the path ahead suggests.
Well, that's good to hear. And it's good to hear that overall that we are reasonably optimistic about the prospects for 2024 and what's obviously going to be a momentous year. Who knows whether a year from now we're all going to be in a much better place, but it does sound like there is a reasonable chance that that will be the situation. So on the basis of that, I think we've nailed it. And you've been listening to Right on the Nail with me, Chris Wright, and thank you to our panellists, Vicky Price, Jess Barnard, and Edward Hardy, for joining me. If you enjoyed the podcast and you haven't already, please follow us and leave a 5-star rating on your podcast app. The episode was produced by Tom Platts and is published by New Thinking. You can find out more at newthinking.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Right on the Nail.